We'll conclude our tribute to the late Shel Epstein, K9 APE, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with a second conversation Rains Hap Holly, KC9RP, conducted with Silent Key Shel Epstein, K9 APE. Shel was an ARRL volunteer counsel, engineer, businessman, as well as a familiar voice on the VHF and UHF bands on Chicago's North Shore for over half a century. Shel passed on November 10, 2014, at the age of 76. In 2002, Rains Hap Holly, KC9RP, conducted a follow-up conversation with Shel that updated Shell's thoughts about the value of risk-taking he discussed in Hap's only other interview with him that we aired last week from 1989.
Our universities and engineering schools taking risks today that they were not willing to take in 89.
Well, Hap, I can't speak for all engineering schools. What I can tell you from my own experience in dealing with higher education is that engineering education has not kept pace with engineering technology or social needs. I taught at Northwestern University for a couple of years subsequent to the interview that you and I did in Dayton. And found that the school had become something of a victim of grade inflation. The reason I ended up teaching at Northwestern is I was asked to do that because Northwestern was concerned that its engineering school graduates couldn't find work after they graduated. And so I volunteered to serve as an adjunct without pay and taught a course called Engineering Design and Entrepreneurship there for a couple of years. What I learned in that experience was that the students were focused on grades and not focused on opportunity. They were bright enough young men and women. The problem was that they had not been properly motivated. What I did is try to introduce the concept of risk-taking into the course. The first thing I was confronted with was the students saying on the first day of class, well, what's going to be on the exam? And so I said, all right, here's what I'm going to do. We're going to give you two exams. One is the midterm and the other one is the final. For the midterm exam, it's going to be multiple choice questions, 40 to 50 of them, somewhere in that range. Each of the questions will have four possible answers. Two answers of the four will be obviously wrong. One will be a distractor in that it appears to be right, but in fact is wrong. And then the fourth one will be the correct answer. We will tell you ahead of time which of the answers is correct and why, because all of the questions and all of the answers will be published for you, and all you have to do is study them. Well, for those of you in Radio Land who are listening to this and saying, gee, that sounds like an amateur radio exam. And in fact, that's exactly what I did. I went ahead and assigned as my midterm exam what was then the general class written element 2-3A-3B. Of the exam, and you had to earn a technician class license, basically a no-code license, in order to pass the midterm exam. And we flunked 16% of the students. Even though they were largely seniors and grad students, they didn't have enough engineering background to pass the general class examination.
16%, almost 20% failed.
Yeah, 1 in 6. My plan originally was to give the extra class exam as the final. Department chairman says, well, we won't give credit for amateur radio exams. So I said, well, how about a commercial radio license? Which, and of course, in those days, element 3 of the general radio operator license exam was the advanced and extra class elements of the written exam. And they went for that. So that was the final exam. And we flunked 16% of the students who took that exam. What I learned from talking to other faculty members was that they had to constantly dumb down their courses in order to maintain enrollment. They were so focused on their own little problems that they never saw the need to motivate the students to basically understand the thrill and excitement that engineering offers. It became a largely academic exercise of, well, we could write this and you could write that. But actually building something, that was foreign to what the professors at Northwestern were willing to do, and certainly foreign to what I had learned when I was an electrical engineering major at MIT. That was a disappointment. I had some impact on the place. I taught students how to write resumes. I taught them some of the ethical considerations that go into engineering. What do you do when you build a technology that some people want to use as a weapon? And, you know, how do you handle those questions? The problem is that when you look at the university systems today, of course, if you go to any school, be it a junior college, say like Oakton Community College, where I actually took a course last quarter on C-sharp programming.
That's here in the Chicago area.
You're right. That's in Des Plaines, Illinois. Very fine community college, a magnet for an immigrant student body. If you go there, you'll find out that, I'm not saying English is a second language over there, but there's certainly a lot of students who come from other countries. And that's a good thing because, you know, you look at what's going on along the Kashmir border between India and Pakistan, and you see people out there, or at least we see that on television, wanting to kill each other. And yet, if you go to Oakton Community College, there are Indians and Pakistanis working side by side, keeping the computers running. So it gives you an idea that maybe this country really does work. The problem, however, is that if you go into a place like Oakton, there must be 500-600 computer terminals in the building, and yet very little is done to teach the students how to use these computers in a creative manner, how to hook them up to the outside world through anything other than an RJ45 jack connected to the internet. And so the opportunities to really build a better mousetrap don't really exist. If you walk from one of the classrooms where there are 35 or 40 computers available for student use, across the hall there's an automotive shop. And there you'll see engines and transmissions disassembled so that the students can get in and learn how an engine works and learn how to repair them, learn how to modify them. There isn't the same commitment in computer education as there is in the auto shop. You could say there's a different skill required. Maybe it's left brain, right brain, and that the folks who are working on automobiles can actually put their hands on the parts, whereas the people who work with computers, you know, you really can't get your hands on the CPU's accumulator. It exists as an abstract concept. You reach it through the keyboard, but you can't actually put a wrench on it. We've not had, at least I've not seen it, any real commitment to the kinds of exploration and research in engineering at the undergraduate level that I experienced when I was an undergraduate student. I've not seen it. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I've not talked to anybody who has the real fire in the belly and walks out of school and says, by God, I had a lot of fun doing that. That concerns me.
You're listening to a 2002 conversation Raines Hap-Holly had with Chicago's former ARRL volunteer counsel, engineer, and businessman, Shel Epstein, K9 APE. We'll conclude their conversation in a moment. This is The Raine Report, available as a weekly tweet on Twitter at hashtag The Raine Report and online at therainreport.com.
You are listening to The Raine Report from www.therainreport.com.
The problem with grades is that they are not reflective of student ability. They're reflective of an instructor's view of the student. And when I was a teacher, I was cognizant of that. I've had discussions with people at admissions officers at MIT and some other schools. And look, the concept that you can go ahead and decide who should be admitted and who should not be admitted and pick the best class is really a fallacy. And the reason it's a fallacy, for example, is that if you look at MIT's admission standards, you won't see somebody like Albert Einstein getting into MIT, because Albert Einstein flunked sophomore math when he was a high school student. You look at MIT, for example, and it has very few undergraduates who are Nobel laureates, and as far as I know, none prior to the class of 1960, which was the class I was in. And then David Baltimore won the first one, and Charles Adler was also in that class, and he won one. Nothing like the record, say, that the University of Chicago has in terms of undergraduates to become Nobel laureates. What would be far better is to say, all right, we'll administer a test like the SAT or the ACT or whatever it is. And these are tests basically of cognitive ability. They're not tests of creative thinking or necessarily problem solving. We'll just go ahead and we'll say 1,400, I don't even know if this is a correct scale anymore because it's been years since I've done this, but let's say anybody over 1,400 stands a reasonably good chance of successfully completing a course of study at MIT or some other school, and below 1,400, the odds are not so good. So go ahead and administer the test. Tell everybody it's a self-grading test. If you got 1,400 or better, you're in the pool, and if you didn't, you're not. Let's talk about MIT now. This pool of maybe 5,000 people who apply, we're going to select one out of five. We're going to get a freshman class of about 1,000. You'd be far better, in my judgment, to pick them at random. In other words, just have the random number generator crank out 1,000 numbers and say, okay, you folks are admitted. You get a far better chance of getting really creative people into the place than you can by having admissions committees read these applications and say, well, that person has attributes that are similar to mine, therefore he or she will be successful at MIT. And that's the fallacy of the admissions program. It depends on grades, and in the case of undergraduate admissions, it depends on grades given by high school teachers, almost all of whom, in my judgment, would never be admitted to an engineering school if anybody took the time to think about it.
But the method you're talking about would require risk-taking.
That's right. You really don't know in making judgments about human beings what the missing dimension is likely to tell you about that person. So far better to go ahead and pick them at random than to think that you can outwit the system. I mean, if you're really that smart, then why don't you buy lottery tickets?
I have spoken to various people at Motorola in recent years. One of the major issues confronting Motorola and other engineering and designing manufacturers is that there are plenty of employees who are well-schooled on paper, but are woefully lacking in street experience, something, of course, which grades cannot tell you and have often nothing to do with.
What was Motorola's hiring policy? Would Motorola consider somebody who didn't have a B-plus average or better? Probably not. And yet, if you look at where invention often comes, it comes from people who reject the conventional wisdom and say, well, you know, that's nonsense, and I'm not going to go down that road. What I want to do is I want to go ahead and go on a different road, which is admittedly high risk, but offers potentially very high rewards, both intellectually and economically. Motorola can complain, and I wouldn't just single out Motorola because there are other companies that have the same problem. Motorola can complain about the problems of the engineers that it hires, but in a sense, it creates its own environment. Let me put it to you in a form of another experience that I had. I was arguing an appeal out in the Ninth Circuit, which is out on the West Coast. We had a local attorney out there. He was the managing partner of a boutique intellectual property law firm, I won't name it. And he said to me, Shelley, he says, you brought some original thinking to this case, and it's not the kind of thinking that I can get out of my partners and associates in this law firm. How do I get diversity of opinion in this law firm? I can't seem to get it. And I said to him, well, have you ever looked at who you hire? They all look like you. They come out of basically the same schools. They have the same grades. They have the same training. There is no diversity in this place. And Motorola had a culture of its own, and if you fit into it, you were expected to conform to a certain template. And as a result, they got the answers that the program was designed to give them. But how can you go into these organizations that believe they have the answer when it's doubtful that they even understand the question? That's the problem. And Motorola has financial results that support my position on this, and other companies do as well.
So the universities are passing students with certain grade point averages who get their degrees but have no real working knowledge of engineering.
Oh, there's no question about it. The Jesuits had it right, though. I don't think it was original with them, but they certainly publicized it when they said, you know, you got to get them young to indoctrinate them. And this is not said in any sense of derogation of the Jesuits, but they're absolutely right. If you want to get people committed to your programs, you got to get them young. And we have to do that in amateur radio. We have to do that in engineering. You have to create an environment where young people are welcome and encouraged to go out and take risk. What's the most important group of people on campus? The most important group of people on campus are the freshman class, because there's virtually little risk to them of making a mistake. Basically, you start out as a freshman and the whole world is open to you. You haven't selected a major in many cases, and you can ask questions. And if they appear to be dumb questions, and I don't believe there are any such things as dumb questions, they have opportunities to make mistakes. Well, you can't make those same mistakes as a senior. Therefore, people tend to clam up. The higher they go in the educational system, the less risk they're willing to take, because the system penalizes you if you don't have the conventionally accepted answer. Yet we know that progress is made by having an answer which is not conventionally acceptable.
And that concludes our conversation with the late Shel Epstein, K9 APE, and tribute to this former ARRL counsel, engineer, and businessman. Shel passed on November 10, 2014, at the age of 76. RAIN founder and producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, remembers Shel for his frank talk and candor, both in life and on amateur radio. He was an active member for some years with the North Shore Radio Club, sponsor of the NS9 RC repeater that airs these RAIN reports Thursday during its 8 p.m. net on 442.725 MHz with a 114.8 PL from Chicago's North Shore. Shel, your frank talk and candor will greatly be missed. The RAIN Report is copyright 1990-2014 RAIN, all rights reserved. I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from The RAIN Report, www.therainreport.com.